Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Now, Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, as I'm sure many of you are expecting to hear Marvin's voice here with me, but I'm reminded of the reality of what it is that he does when he's not on the air, and that is he's out there helping young people. So he is working at a school right now, helping quite a few young people. So, and as you know, I'm always very proud of that because that's what we do. So, you know, at this point, I just want to share with everybody that one of the key things with working with young people is training. And it really comes down to the fact that anybody, if you're going to be in that position, be it working in a school, you know, working in a specialized program, or even those of us just as parents, you know, if our child gets a little out of control, being able to de-escalate is such a huge issue. And it's so very important to be able to sit back and know, what is it that I should do? Where should I draw the line? And I'm really happy to have as our guest today, Matt Smith, and he's going to be talking about that. Now, Matt is the founder and chief instructor at Aegis Training Solutions. Matt has spent over a decade in the field of mental and behavioral health care. He has been employed in frontline care, behavioral intervention, and staff development. Now, he has worked in many environments such as therapeutic boarding schools, residential treatment, acute psychiatric, and in wilderness therapy. And Matt has managed hundreds of incidents where the skills of de-escalation were critical to the safety of all involved. So, Matt, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thanks so much, Alan. Really glad to be on the show.
Well, I'm glad to have you on. I mean, as someone who started working with at-risk youth over 30 years ago, it was one of the things that I realized there wasn't a whole lot of back then, and that was training. It was sort of, you know, on-the-job training. So, you know, I'm very, very thankful that there are people like yourself that have put together training programs that can allow those of us working with the kids to really be able to put our best foot forward.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think it is a critical part of the process, and really glad to be working with a lot of sophisticated programs. So, yeah, I appreciate it.
Now, let's start with the name of the company. What is the definition of Aegis?
Aegis, it's an ancient word. It means the power to protect and support, quite simply. And we really, when the beginnings of Aegis and our vision, we first wanted to stay away from another acronym. Who needs another TLA, right?
You mentioned that you weren't really looking for another acronym because we certainly have tons of them to deal with. And you were saying in regards to what it means, which I think makes sense.
Right, yeah, and we chose the word as a theme for the whole system, and if you have a chance to check out the logo at aegissystem.com, it's really intended to set the tone for our philosophical approach and the perspectives, the attitudes, the beliefs we're trying to inspire in staff teams and at point of care.
Now, and you just mentioned as far as the website, and which is the aegissystem.com, but for anybody out there, let me spell it for you because I missed it the first time. So it would be just T-H-E, and then Aegis is actually spelled A-E-G-I-S GIS, and then it's system, system.com. Again, if you're not driving and you're sitting at your desk, you want to open up another window, feel free to, and you can sort of follow along with us on some of the things that Matt is sharing with us. So, Matt, let's talk about crisis intervention. And let's, explain a little bit for everybody. I mean, you know, what is intervention? What are some of the ways in which, we can intervene in such a way that it keeps it from becoming an issue where it escalates or becomes physical?
Right, sure. So crisis intervention is it's not my favorite term, to be transparent, but it is the most recognizable term on the national and international scale, and it simply refers to any situation where a behavior or an unmet need presents some type of unsafe situation. It can be in the home front. It can be, most typically for our frame of reference, it would be in a clinical environment, inpatient, outpatient, private or public educational settings, things like that. So to tee this up, the two buckets or the two components of our training as it relates to managing crisis is, of course, de-escalation and physical intervention. The de-escalation model that Aegis uses, or has become a more recognizable term even amongst other vendors, is simply the verbal and paraverbal skills. Your effort to maintain rapport and also, of course, prevent the need for physical intervention.
Now, define the difference between the verbal and the paraverbal skills.
So what's unique about our model is we use a lot of nonverbal communication and empower staff to apply that within, crisis intervention. So paraverbal would just mean simply utilizing nonverbal communication to de-escalate and calm an unsafe situation.
All right. So So share with everybody a little bit on how these services impact the overall therapeutic process.
You know, a big reason why I'm on the path I'm on and why, collectively all the thought leaders we have at Aegis are on the same page is because we've all been deeply impressed with how impactful crisis is in the therapeutic process as a whole. Typically, it's a crisis situation that says to a parent, communicates to a parent, okay, my child has unmet needs. We need some support. We need some help. And then within a clinical environment, all the negative aspects of treatment, such as potential for trauma, any mismanagement, things like that, all revolve around mismanaged crisis. And throughout my professional and personal journey, I've been deeply affected by that. And I had the privilege of having a really positive frame of reference for how crisis was managed well. And then on the flip side of the coin, I had a frame of reference, unfortunately, I've had several, for what it looks like when they're not. So both ends of that spectrum have been deeply impactful on me.
Well, give us an example of both. I've also been in this industry, a long time as well, and I know that we've all seen a lot of things. So just kind of walk everybody through. I know in your training there's role playing and things like that. So sort of role play out something to where here's the right way to do it, here's the wrong way to do it.
Sure. Now, on the negative side of things, of course, it's when there is, unfortunately, an injury or unnecessary trauma. It's not in our control as care providers to insulate a child or an adult in our care from pain, but there's no need for there to be suffering revolving around crisis. So acutely, a mismanaged crisis situation, when it begins, staff didn't see it coming. They don't have any indication of crisis coming. It caught them off guard. And then the acute crisis, the actual unsafe behavior, maybe it's self-injury, maybe it's interpersonal physical aggression, but that was managed poorly, meaning they didn't execute prescribed techniques. It ended up in a fray or a tussle. And then after the incident, there was no follow-up with that child, with that client or student that was put in an intervention. There's no mitigation on the agency side of things, and there's no reestablishment of rapport with that client or that student. Now, that would be the negative negative side of things. On the positive side of things, which fortunately we have a lot of, we have a lot of success stories. You know, we see our clients every year on an annual basis, so we collect a lot of feedback. We are always in touch with our certified trainers, just checking in all the time. So on the positive side of things, staff see the incident coming, and there's nothing more positive than a potentially unsafe situation being resolved without going hands-on. And what that looks like specifically is staff seeing it coming, fitting a process using the Aegis system and the framework that we provide to have a process with that child or that student and de-escalate it without the need for going hands-on. That can have a number of different durations depending on the atmospherics and what's at play, but that is obviously the ideal outcome. Now, if there is the inescapable need for physical intervention, for staff to go hands-on, it happens quick. A safe position is achieved, the Aegis safety position would be achieved, and then when the timing is right, that child, that client, that student would be, rapport would be reestablished. There would be an appropriate sequence of events for documentation and post-incident follow-up. On the agency side and on the consumer side, there would be communication to the family, and a rapport would be reestablished. There would be clinical support. There would be full cooperation, and this would be all in a prescribed manner, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes great sense. And to kind of highlight a couple of points that you brought up, because I think they're very important. One has to do with timing, you know, the timing of things. You know, when you mention in regards to when the situation comes up to where you do have to lay hands, you know, in many cases, as you know, and you can touch on it a little bit more, if the person has not become a danger to themselves or others, and they're acting out, but their behavior is not necessarily a potential danger to themselves or others, how do you use time to your benefit so that you can get to that place of therapeutic rapport?
Right, right. It's a critical factor, you know. So on one end of the spectrum, I would look at an inpatient setting. Maybe let's talk about wilderness therapy as a frame of reference. I spent many years in wilderness therapy. So the benefit of that is time. You know, with that type of intervention and that type of clinical environment, time is on your side. So that enables more of a process. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, there's an urgent need. There's a medical concern we need to get from point A to point B to maintain the safety of this individual. So time may not be on your side in that case, but there is always time to attempt de-escalation. Rarely would there be an instance where there isn't the time. I mean, we've run some empirical data, and I would say with confidence, 88% of the time you have this incredible space and you're empowered to have a discussion, to have a process. And furthermore, it's when you're de-escalating an unsafe situation, it's not always what you say in the moment. It could be what you said the day before. It could be what you said when you met somebody. It's the type of intentional relationship you build and what you communicate verbally and non-verbally. So it's not, that's what I would like to emphasize. In a clinical environment, we align with the milieu. We align with the intentionality of a program and recognize that in our system, something that I believe is unique to our approach is it's not a cause and effectual type of dynamic. It's we're going to see this coming. We're going to be two steps ahead of it. And that's how you prevent and de-escalate and, you know, eliminate the need for physical intervention. In some agencies, they report success with quite literally eliminating the need, or we have one physical incident every 2 years, things like that.
Well, exactly, and which brings us right to the point of the value of training. If the training has come ahead of time and they've been walked through certain scenarios, it doesn't come as a surprise, which again, that's when you brought it up in the very beginning. You said one of the biggest problems is when this comes at them as a surprise and then they're not prepared for it. So again, it makes perfect sense. Now, you talked a little bit from the standpoint of in regards to the verbal when you're establishing rapport. But from a verbal standpoint, let's talk a little bit about questions, because I know that, you know, you can approach things based on asking the right questions that may get you the answers that allows the person to de-escalate themselves.
Certainly. And you might call it the art of asking questions. That's a term we'll use fondly at our trainings. And Back to alignment. So throughout the intervention process, what makes a crisis intervention, what eliminates suffering, what allows people to move forward, what makes it intentional is fitting it into an individualized treatment plan. And what we are doing to de-escalate is exercising personal power, empowering staff with the ability to connect and build rapport. There's obvious alignment there with an overall therapeutic process. Now, on a foundational level, the listener steers the conversation. And we want to coach our staff. An effective intervention involves listening, more listening than speaking. So what we coach our staff to do is direct the conversation using empathic communication and asking intentional questions, and then sending a very intentional nonverbal message. If a staff were to ask a question, "Hey, what's going on with you?" while their body is communicating disinterest or irritation, you know, they're not their chosen words, but their nonverbal communication, that trumps the chosen word. So it negates the message that staff are sending. So we'll start there, and we'll foster this empathic communication process in staff, which when empathy is achieved, it organically staff will, when they're exercising empathy, will ask a lot of questions.
I was going to say, and I think that's a great point, because it goes to that thing of sometimes it's not always what you say, but how you say it. That same question, if it's perceived by them as a challenge question, now you've escalated things. If it's perceived by them as an informational with something to where they believe you actually are concerned about that, now it's an informational question, and in most cases is going to do just the opposite.
Certainly. And the other intention of asking questions is a lot – if you just look at a lot of interpersonal conflict in a general sense – I think that conflict escalates when either side is not feeling heard. Not their perspective isn't validated. They're not feeling like their sent message is being received. So by quite simply, where we start with, you know, crisis intervention is not hitting home runs. It's getting on base. It's a process. So we coach our staff in the system to achieve an understanding by asking questions. Let me reflect. Using reflective listening is very similar to exercising empathy and asking intentional questions. So we can't begin to de-escalate a person until we understand how they see the world, their emotional experience, their attitudes, thoughts, and beliefs associated with, you know, whatever negative emotion they're experiencing. Assumably in crisis, that's what's going on. So that all starts with the process of asking very intentional questions.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. So now, in those situations where you have asked all the most therapeutic questions, you have learned as much as you can, but the person is still not responding. It could be in some cases because they're on some sort of a drug that is keeping them from de-escalating. What would be share with us some of the best practices when it comes to having to do a physical intervention?
Right. So that when the inescapable need arises, you know, like a transporting situation or an intake where it's clearly not in our control to de-escalate a person and we're in charge of their safety, we would reference something called an intervention model. And that guides staff through, you know, there's so much situational variance in crisis intervention. A frame of reference like the intervention model helps staff to make these decisions. Now, when we engage a client, the weight of having to put your hands on someone in a clinical environment, that inescapable need, we don't take that lightly by any means. So we, as a team here at Aegis, we scoured the country internationally, and we looked for the best answer. Now, what happens, the way that process works, is we'll prescribe best practice, or we'll prescribe specific techniques to use that we deem to be safe. And let me share the definition of safe. So each one of our techniques meets certain levels of acceptability. First, it's worked in real time. What's unique about our model is that it's 100% experience-based. We pull from our team. We have we're a small firm, but we have a robust network of consultants. So every year we go under a full curriculum review, and we don't use a single technique in a system that hasn't worked in real time in real situations to achieve safety. So then we take that experience base and we back it up with empirical evidence. We back it up with support that you can hold in your hand, data. And that's the laborious part. It's been in the past a big part of my personal mission. And then we go ahead and classify it as benevolent, meaning the intention of the technique is to maintain safety and the continuation of the therapeutic process.
Okay. Now give us a little bit of an idea of, you know, the type of people that are coming to your trainings now, and the value and feedback that you're getting of how it's making them do their job so much better.
Right. We get key staff or administrators from various age, inpatient, outpatient, residential. We work with a lot of therapeutic boarding schools, and we'll get key clinical staff, key administrators, or more experienced staff that do a lot of staff development. And the feedback we get is just we're different for the aforementioned reasons. And it's not we're our effort is to inspire and motivate staff through empowerment, to encourage an attitude or a positive way of thinking in reference to crisis. So the feedback is it's a leap of faith and a vote of confidence in training, and then we position everything for staff and our trainers to make their own connections, to dial in from their personal experience, to go back and make the de-escalation model work for their own agency, for their internal workings. It's just not our place to tell a room full of clinicians how to do therapy.
Yeah, but you're really not trying to tell them how to do therapy. You know, you're trying to tell them how to manage a situation when they're not able to do therapy. I mean, really,
right? Right.
But
it has a different flavor on the physical intervention side. It does have a different flavor. The techniques need to be applied and replicated, you know, flawlessly.
Yeah, and you know, you were talking a little bit about feedback, and I want to touch on that a little bit, because I mean, prior to setting up this, and I think as a lot of people that listen know, I mean, we schedule these, you know, a good 6 or 8 weeks in advance, so it gave me some time to contact some of the programs where you've provided the training, and I've gotten really great feedback, and so much so that I've now scheduled some of my people to go to your training, even though I'm a certified instructor in another type of training, but there's an interesting thing that I've realized, and this is another reason why I'm now having my people go to yours, which is after a while, the same training over and over gets old. And I'm realizing that some of the people that have been with us a long time, you know, as I'm going through a particular type of, you know, of training or a role-playing situation, I'm not getting the same enthusiasm, you know, as they're going through it. So again, having talked to people who have gone through yours, the fact that you are really, when you mentioned earlier, you are getting them so involved, and that it is different, and you know that there are different aspects of it that seems to keep them on their toes, and I like that. So again, if people out there, if you know, you're out there going, oh well, you know, we've been having such and such do our training for the last, you know, 35 years, well, you know what, it may be time to bring in a new type of training that can really go in and show your people maybe something a little bit different that may bring that enthusiasm back.
Right, and I really appreciate that feedback. It's great to hear, Alan. You know, we're going to be excited to be working with all your folks, and that's something that, again, really motivated me on a personal level. What has driven me is the impact that crisis intervention training has on the experience of a child in treatment. And I recognize, I know from previous conversations that we've had, Alan, we both saw that out there, you know, in terms of this market segment. It's something, crisis intervention, I believe personally it needed to evolve. We needed to have solutions and a system that recognize that a lot of these advanced models, a lot of these top-tier sophisticated programs can walk and chew gum, and we can have a different approach, like you said, to inspire and motivate and not say you do X, Y, and Z when you see A and B, but have a conversation, motivate, inspire, empower, teach them more advanced principles, not shy away from a philosophical conversation or a cultural atmospheric conversation at training. And that's something that really drives us, and one of the things I think that is different about the Aegis experience, hopefully.
Well, it's much appreciated. Now, we're going to take a break. We are talking about safety first for staff and patients. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Don't go anywhere. We will be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. We are talking with Matt Smith, and his company is Aegis Training Solutions. And we're really talking about safety, because it's about safety for the staff, and it's about safety for the patients and the young people that we're working with. Now, with that being said, we have an email coming in that is coming from a parent. So, you know, we may be able to discuss a little bit as to how some of this may be used in the home. This email reads, "In the last few months, our teenage son has started bullying his younger brother and two sisters. On two occasions, he was so angry and out of control that we were actually afraid of what might happen or what he might do. We put him and the entire family into counseling, but honestly, we don't see much change as of yet. After reading about your work in the press release, I would like to know if crisis intervention training for my husband and I would be helpful, or as parents, are we too emotionally close to the situation for this to be effective?"
Right. Interesting question. You know, when it comes to crisis intervention in the home, you know, I would steer the attention to our de-escalation model. Physical intervention is not appropriate for us to consult or advise in a home setting. We only work in that arena within a clinical organization. All the same, the answer is always on de-escalation. So I would certainly recognize that it's different. You know, as a staff or a paraprofessional or a clinical worker in a therapeutic environment, we're more insulated from the emotional experience of raising a child and the attachment that comes with it. So with that said, there's a lot of relevance in our de-escalation model to the home setting. We are looking at providing more specialized or custom seminars for the parents, which does not include physical intervention, but simply de-escalation, as 75% of our model is de-escalation.
Yeah, and I think to add to that, and I think you touched on it a little bit as well, Matt, is to these parents, this child has, and it says teenage, so let's say he's 15, 16 years old, he's got 15 years experience at pushing your buttons. one of the advantages that we have when we are working with a young person is they don't know our buttons. They haven't had practice since they were very little in knowing exactly how to push your buttons. So I would imagine that going through some sort of training to at least recognize, you know, when your buttons are being pushed, you know, and how you can, you know, you can kind of keep that from altering what you know is probably the right thing to do could be very advantageous. Your thoughts, Matt?
Certainly, yeah. And we, relating it back to the curriculum and what our de-escalation model could offer that specific parent, would be there in frontline care, in the home front, you know, we always see this, time and time again, we see this correlation between how effective our interventions are, how intentional our interactions are, how effective we are at supporting another person, all correlates to the work we're doing on ourselves and the work we're willing to do on ourselves. So we'll typically, within the framework of Aegis and how it might relate to an answer for that question, would be to start with a one-person psychology, you know, recognizing what we can do to take care of ourselves, to empower ourselves in the moment.
Now, in as you're talking about in regards to empowering yourself, it makes me think a little bit about the staff health, that one of the issues that I'm concerned about is the staff welfare from the standpoint of being able to have a place to kind of de-escalate yourself, being able to pull back from a situation and make sure that you're taking the time to take care of yourself so that you don't have a situation to where these things build up on you. Now, does your course touch on that so that the people that are now coming into it recognize the importance of making sure that they've taken care of themselves, because if they don't take care of themselves, they're not going to be at their best to work with these young people?
Certainly, yes. We have section one of the model is under staff empowerment. The first part of it is what our term for that would be stress inoculation. You know, we recognize mm-hmm. and validate that a crisis situation, acute crisis at point of care or in the home front, is quite stressful. 96% of all people have a phobic type of reaction to interpersonal aggression, family or not. So we recognize that we need to take care of ourselves by managing our own stress levels. That enables us to have a more resourceful response, make more intentional decisions, and it really is a primer for the whole system. Now, our recipe for stress inoculation is rooted in cognitive behavioral psychoanalytics, and we recognize that the stress component is cognitive, behavioral, and physiological, and we have specific techniques we'll use on each end to maintain a healthy cognition. We'll use breathing techniques, and really it's a systems approach to maintaining a calm, resourceful state in crisis.
Okay, now can you give us some examples, from the standpoint of, you have an acting out person, for this situation, let's say that they're in a psychiatric hospital setting, you have an acting out person, and you have two staff members that have now been asked to come into the room because the therapist now believes that it's beyond, their ability to handle it. So walk us through a little bit in regards to some of the techniques that may be used in that situation.
Certainly. If I'm one of those two staff members, let's paint that picture.
Okay.
Even being called in by the clinician to manage that situation, I'm still sticking to my de-escalation techniques. So arriving at that point of care, I'm using my stress inoculation techniques. I'm reminding myself to use a non-judgmental approach. If I'm expecting to, or it's been reported that there's some unsafe behavior, let's call it self-injury in this context, I'm going to recognize that I might refract or I might put that behavior in a box in some way, shape, or form. I might be predisposed to that to soothe myself, while I'm witnessing this unsafe behavior. So I'm going to recognize that I need to maintain a non-judgmental approach here. I'm going to maintain calm. I'm going to employ breathing techniques. I'm going to maintain a healthy self-talk internally. So I'm going to maintain a healthy one-person psychology. Now, when I enter the room, there's a few things that I'm going to be very attentive to. Let's say I'm running point on this intervention and the other staff, maybe they're less experienced than me and they're walking into the room with me. I'm going to be hyper-vigilant of how I'm being received non-verbally. When someone is in crisis, they're what we would call potentially, commonly, emotionally hijacked. Their heart rate is escalated. They're not in their frontal lobes as much as they were if they were calm and collected, meaning their caveman self is coming to bear, coming to light. So when I walk in, there's a few things I'm very, very intentional about. I do not want to have a threatening presentation and trigger an adverse response from that individual's limbic system, you know, their caveman self, their caveman brain. So what I'm going to do is walk in and be very cautious of my proximity. I'm going to leave a couple, for lack of a better term, body lengths away. I'm going to show that person the palms of my hands. I'm going to keep my hands open. I'm going to use a calm, collective analog component in my speech patterns. I'm going to speak very slowly and very clearly to make sure they're hearing and what I'm saying. I'm going to initiate a de-escalation process. I'm going to try to initiate a dialogue. Now, while that's happening, I'm quite simply reflecting. Hopefully, they're using their words, and I'm going to reflect their chosen message. Now, within that process, within that communication loop of what's being sent and received, it's not in this moment, I'm recognizing that it's not just what that individual is sending to me. It's what I'm observing. It's what their emotions look like. Okay, if that person, let's use the example of self-harm. If there's some self-harm present, I'm going to be very judicious with my language and insulate myself from the process as to not be perceived as shaming in any way. I'm not going to trigger that cycle or push that cycle any further. Let's go into another example. Let's say that person is angry. Okay, we're in a closed room. They're going to be feeling cornered. I'm going to sidestep. I'm not going to get in the way of that person and the door. I may have to intervene if they run through the door. All the same, I'm not going to invade their proximics and get in front of them and create an interpersonal wall. And all the same, I'm going to be looking at what's going on. It's a bit of a forensic process in this situation because I wouldn't expect their chosen words to communicate the depth of their emotional experience. So I'm observing, I'm understanding, I'm in information gathering mode. And usually that will reveal a pressure valve or something that the way I can influence and steer the conversation away from aggression. In the event of anger, what we'll often see, especially with young men, is that there's something behind the anger. We coach people to literally learn what emotions look like. So young men are allowed to feel anger or they're allowed to be the funny guy. In this situation of anger, we'll see a lot of leakage in the nonverbal presentation. And you'll see fear or sadness, needing to preserve an identity or whatever else is going on with them. So that's a different conversation than blind aggression.
Now, in the situation we started with the therapist, or it could be a parent or someone, is it your belief that at that point, if that anger is being directed towards a particular person, that one of the first things that you want to do is to get them out? Get the other person away?
Oh, certainly, yeah. You know, especially with anger or whatever, whenever possible, you know, we would call that an approach consideration. You know, you want to remove that negative stimulus.
Yeah.
So, of course, that's definitely consideration. And now, if that situation were to continue to escalate to a point where, you know, they were actively self-harming or actively striking, now it would be safe to say there is the inescapable need to intervene physically. And on a very, you know, tip of the iceberg level, we intervene when the risk of not intervening is clearly outweighed by the risk of intervening. And in that moment, we would employ physical intervention solutions that are benevolent and as inobtrusive as possible. We'd use one of four specific techniques to achieve the Aegis safety position, because in that moment, in your specific example, empirically, our biggest concerns are what is known as positional asphyxia. That's what the research is conclusive about. What happens when these situations are mismanaged is that staff will end up in a dog pile type of situation. There'll be a fray, and that can't happen because anything that happens needs to be in a 100% prescribed manner. So the Aegis safety position, first and foremost, does not use prone or supine positioning, which is on the ground laying face down or face up. So it's absolutely critical, and I think an important assessment when choosing what kind of facility or what kind of program is right for your child. I would not send my child to an agency that uses prone or supine positioning. It's conclusive. So we eliminated the need. That's one of the things that separates us, and I have a lot of energy about the importance of. We eliminated the need for that kind of intervention. Our system also safeguards against, you know, thrashing, head thrashing, and things like that.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point, because if part of this acting out is coming from low self-esteem or some other particular issues, you know, putting somebody face down on the floor is not improving that situation. You're actually exasperating the problem rather than trying to get them closer to therapeutic rapport. So I certainly understand. We have another email question that we want to ask. This one comes in. This one says, teachers are on the front lines when youth get out of control. I am a counselor at a high school in New Jersey, and there was an amazing 30% drop in school suspensions and violent incidences since our teachers attended crisis intervention classes last year. I believe strongly that these classes should be mandatory nationwide for educators as well as law enforcement, where it seems the emphasis has been placed in our state. Can you give us your thoughts about this?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something, again, that I have a lot of energy about. There's a lot of benefits to crisis intervention training. First and foremost, it empowers teachers, staff, anyone that manages interpersonal situations to focus on de-escalation. So it prevents the need to overcompensate or undercompensate in crisis, to overreact or underreact in crisis. The next level would be that it creates a framework. We're all speaking the same language, whether it's the counselor at that public high school or it's the teacher in the classroom. There's consistency throughout that continuum of care or intervention. And it's a game-changing, you know, positive externality effect on the culture of any agency that works with youth or at-risk youth.
Yeah. You know, have you contacted any people in the public school system? Is there any traction in trying to get something going like this?
You know, there is, and that's in the future of Aegis. A lot of our competitors do really well in the public education setting. You know, we're built to participate in public education. We do a lot in private education. A lot of our clients are therapeutic boarding schools that have a strong education component and want that consistency from, you know, therapy to the classroom. So yes, certainly a lot of our competitors have done really well in that arena. And I think one of the reasons we have not done as much in public education is we're niched in mental and behavioral health. We're custom built for it. And we seem to be received very well there. So, you know, as we evolve, yeah, we definitely want to bring our system and emphasis on training into the public education arena.
Yeah, it makes good sense to me. In fact, I was sent, I think once we sent out the press release and it was listed on here that we were going to have you on the show, I was sent about 2.5 weeks ago a YouTube video that was shot, I guess, by a student inside a classroom that got completely out of control, and apparently one of the kids did something wrong. The teacher corrected them or whatever, and I'm not sure how the parent happened to be there or whatever, but the parent of the child knocked the teacher out. A female parent of the child knocked the female teacher out, and And as I was looking at this video, and I was just thinking that, there's obviously no, there was no training, there was no way of handling this. You know, in my mind, I'm thinking, why was the parent there? All of the things that maybe other people weren't thinking about, but I'm looking at it from a situation and saying, this entire situation is out of control. Nobody seemed to know how to keep this from getting to this point to begin with. I don't know. Have you seen that one?
I haven't seen that one, but unfortunately, I've seen a lot just like it.
Yeah.
And it, you know, from our perspective, it's motivating. You're looking at a room full of tragic and grievous expressions of unmet needs. Some basic, if you injected an insulated approach and some reflective listening into any of those conversations and some appropriate techniques, there's no violence, really. I mean, ultimately, our mission is to prevent violence.
Well, I just looked over at the time. We've got about 3.5 minutes. Tell us a little bit about, as far as trainings, I believe you have some upcoming trainings coming up. How can people get a hold of you if they're listening, if they are a teacher and they're going, I definitely want to go to my superiors and figure out how I can be part of this. Where can they go to find that out? And where do you have some of your trainings coming up? Because I believe you have them all over the country.
We do, yeah. We do. I live out of a suitcase these days. I'm on personally. I do. I do. I just swap out fresh laundry. It just stays packed. And we have trainings all over the country. So we parachute into different locations. We utilize major hotel space. So we also have a number of private trainings that aren't on the calendar. So we hope people will reach out to us. We'll be able to get something on the calendar. I do most of our trainings personally. Anything to get me away from the desk and keep me away from the business side of things. We're really fortunate to have a strong team in that regard with some fantastic business resources. So I do as many trainings as I can. The AegisSystem.com is where we run all our traffic through. There's plenty of information up there and contact details. So it's certainly a good place to start.
Now, and I noticed, you have two different trainings listed on the site. What's the difference between the blue and the green training?
It's more of the level. All of our trainings utilize the same de-escalation model, and all of our trainings and certifications, ultimately that's what we do at the end of training, of course, use the Aegis safety position. The main difference is green versus blue. Now, the blue system was built for it's a level lower than green. So it's our version of applying the best fit for the needs of all the agencies we work with, because we can't just modify a system. It's a semi-custom fit. So we do it to accommodate different type of engagements. An adjudicated youth facility does not need the same version of physical intervention that an outpatient clinic in Ohio does. I wouldn't get too hung up on that in the website. Well, the way we handle integration is always with a lot of heavy consulting up front to make sure it's a good fit. We have a very honest discussion, and a short conversation reveals which version of blue versus green is best fit. And we also work with a lot of hands-off programs, quote-unquote.
Okay. Again, before we run out of time, if there is anything else that you would like to share, again, for those people, if you are, if you want to get in touch, if you're driving, if you couldn't write that down, you can go to our site, go to answers4thefamily.com. We will have all the information on there for, the Aegis system. And again, it's the AegisSystem.com. Matt, thank you so much. I know that in August you're going to be out here in LA. So maybe we can set something up and we can have you come in studio and touch on a few other things that people can do to help them keep their staff and their patients safe.
Yeah, thank you so much, Alan, for having me. We'll look forward to catching up in August, and it'd be great to pop into the studio and field some calls, get into some more specific examples on the home front and things like that. So thanks again, and best.
You're very welcome. Take care. And for everybody else out there, be with us next week. Listen to us on Answers, the numeral for the family. Our topic is going to be Democracy's Education, Public Work, Citizenship, and the Future of Colleges and Universities. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.